Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грегор Олиар.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show from The Guardian. Hugo Lowell is here. If you are on Twitter, you know that name because he is the congressional correspondent for the great newspaper The Guardian and has been covering the Select Committee, the January 6th committee, and giving us scoop after scoop after scoop. Just great reporting by him. I asked him to come on the show because yesterday, as you're listening to this, yesterday was the anniversary of the insurrection, and I wanted to talk about it on the program. So I thought, who better than the reporter who's been just doing a great job doing the coverage? So he came on, smart guy, great conversation. There's good stuff in there. I really enjoyed it, and you will too. We're going to get to that in a minute. Guys, I'm thrilled to announce our sponsor. I'd like to thank BetterHelp for supporting Prevail. For 10% off your first month, go to BetterHelp, that's HELP.com/Greg. Start living a better life today. As I'm recording this, it's January 5th. We have listened to Merrick Garland, the Attorney General of these United States, make a speech. Basically, he did what I and Lincoln's Bible and a bunch of other people have been urging him to do for, I don't know, how long has he been there? 9 months now, you know, which is basically give a speech, articulate to the American people what your priorities are, assure us, reassure us that the bad guys aren't going to get away with it. And look, he's not a great public speaker by any stretch of the imagination, but I thought the speech was good. I thought that he came across well. I thought he explained things well. I thought he seemed passionate about it. It suggested to me that he does prioritize January 6th and getting to the bottom of it. Certainly, that's what it sounded like. He said all the right things, and I walked away from it feeling encouraged. The best part of it, I thought, for me, was how he kind of took his time explaining how, okay, we indict somebody for a misdemeanor, for trespassing or something. And that's how it starts. And it doesn't mean there's not superseding indictments, what he said. So he basically explained and kind of assuaged the doubters who think, hey, everybody's just going to get away with this, or they're going to get away with a slap on the wrist. Now it seems to be much less likely. So I walked away from it feeling better. I wish he had done this speech sooner. I think it would have been better if he did it 3 months ago, 4 months ago, 6 months ago. But I'm glad he did it, and I've been calling on him to do just this, so I'm not going to kill the guy for doing what I've been asking him to do. I'm going to say, great, thank you, Merrick Garland, I appreciate it. Now, again, these are words, as people have pointed out on Twitter. These are words. Well, of course they're words. That's what we've been wanting him to do, is give us words to pump into the narrative and put into the public discourse to combat all the fucking lies from the other side, right? So he gave us words. That's what we wanted. He did a good job. Words are great for now. Ultimately, as he said in the speech, he said, judge us by our actions. Ultimately, you know, it's going to be the actions that determine whether or not this guy is for real. So we need indictments. We need lots of indictments. And we need the right people indicted. We have people like Steve Bannon, people like Mike Flynn, people like Roger Stone that are just stirring up trouble, that are just, they want another insurrection. Last week on the show, Tom Joseph said he compared January 6th to the first attack on the World Trade Center, which was, as Sherry Jacobus said, chilling. We want to make sure this doesn't happen again. And the way to make sure it doesn't happen again is to get the people that want it to happen and are in the best positions to make it happen and detain them, charge them, make sure that they are, you know, not able to do what they want to do. I mean, this isn't rocket science. So good job by Merrick Garland. We need more. We need action now. Like I said, I'm not going to kill the guy for not, you know, I didn't expect this week for him to have this speech and then say, right now, as I'm saying this, FBI agents are going all over the country arresting blah, blah, blah. You know, that's a pipe dream. But still, I did feel reassured by the speech. I really did. I know other people didn't. I know other people were like, oh, everyone's going to get away with it. Nothing ever changes, blah, blah, blah. Maybe they're right. I don't know. You know, ultimately, this bought him some time. It reassured some folks. But what we do need ultimately is indictments. Nothing's going to happen without indictments. I think they're coming. That seemed to be the tenor of the speech, is that, hey, guys, you know, we're working on this. This is why it's taking so long. We are not going to rest until everybody responsible for this is in jail, blah, blah, blah. He said the right things, you know. I don't think he's a liar. I don't think he's a mendacious person. So, you know, let's take him at his word. Let's give him time. Let's see what he does. I would like, again, I would like him to indict Trump on the Mueller report stuff. I don't know why he's not doing that. There's other things that could be done too. But if this is where the focus is and this is how we're going to get the bad guys, then let's get the bad guys. So that's all I got to say about Merrick Garland. We'll be right back with Hugo Lowell.
What do you get for the man who has everything? You know who I'm talking about. He's already got a Patek Philippe, a Picasso, an Airbus 380. I mean, what do you get for a guy like that? Well, have you thought about buying him a Supreme Court justice? Hi, I'm Leonard Leo. I run the Federalist Society and the Judicial Crisis Network, and honestly, there's so many of these organizations I lose track, but I'm basically a real estate broker only for Supreme Court justices. I know, it sounds crazy, but Supreme Court justices are cheaper than you think. One time, my client acquired one in exchange for a Washington Nationals season ticket package. Supreme Court justices make great gifts. Wait till you see the look on his face when he opens his very own Sam Alito. Want to buy a Supreme Court justice? Just head over to my eBay store, which is ebay.com/KnightOfMaltaScotusPimp, and click Buy Now. Enter promo code BOOF to get 10% off your first purchase. You won't be sorry. Believe me, a Picasso ain't nothing next to a Gorsuch. It's the gift that keeps on giving. And now, back to the show.
Hugo Lowell, welcome to the Prevail podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you. And before we get started, I want to say right up front, great job. You're doing a really, really good job, because every time I go on Twitter, I'm like, this guy's broken yet another story about what the Select Committee is up to and getting the truth out. And I think that certainly on my podcast, I've complained about the job that the media does a lot. So I feel like it's really important to acknowledge when members of the media are kicking ass. So good job by you. That's the first thing I have to say. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
Now, before we talk about all the J6 stuff and I pick your brain about the various people involved and all that kind of stuff, tell me a little bit about your background and how you're the congressional correspondent for The Guardian. How did you get to be the congressional correspondent for The Guardian? Because I checked on you before this happened, and I was surprised at, you know, at how young you are. It's really remarkable. You're a prodigy, I suppose. Is that it?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I guess I started quite early in terms of reporting. So before I covered politics, I covered sports and money in sports and sports politics. So maybe actually it's not so much of a giant leap to go from corruption in sports to go to corruption in government. In fact, it's probably all the same thing anyway. But I started off reporting in high school, actually, for a mid-sized national newspaper in the UK. It was called the I Newspaper. It's the print version of the Independent. It has a bit of a storied history along with the Independent. Anyway, the UK media landscape is complicated. But I covered athletics, so track and field, and I covered a bit of FIFA. But the most interesting thing that I covered was the Russian doping scandal. And this kind of took me from London to Moscow, to Lausanne, to Zurich. And I covered a lot of the IOC, that's the International Olympic Committee, and FIFA, which is the International Soccer Federation. And it was at a time that FIFA and the IOC were in a lot of trouble ethically. They had a whole bunch of really corrupt bids for World Cups and Olympics. And the Russian doping scandal kind of tied everything together when at the Sochi Games, Russia was busy swapping out tainted urine samples off their athletes to ensure that they could win gold medals illicitly. And it was all state sponsored. And this was, I guess, my first foray into covering government malfeasance. And then at some point, this all kind of came to its natural end. And I always thought, well, it's much more interesting to cover politics than sports. But even when I cover sports, I cover the business of sport more than the actual, you know, championships and the Olympics, although I did cover that as well. And that kind of naturally led me into the Trump administration and all the malfeasance that happened there, both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, both at the White House and at Congress. And January 6th happened, and I was ostensibly supposed to be doing some leadership reporting for The Guardian covering Democrats in Congress, specifically House Democrats in Congress. And it was around the time that Pelosi was trying to figure out if they had the votes to create a bipartisan or nonpartisan 9/11 style commission to investigate the Capitol attack. And of course, as we now know, they couldn't, but this kind of grew organically. And at some point I just turned around to my editors and said, you know, this is going to be a big deal. It's going to be the number one investigation and we should get on this. And that's kind of how the January 6th Select Committee beat started. And I imagine it's probably similar for a lot of my colleagues on the Hill. It kind of all started in earnest just before the summer. They went on recess, and then in September, we started getting our first subpoenas. And 3 months later, we're deep into this investigation.
I think that's remarkable. I mean, to cover the sports business at the time of the doping scandal and the FIFA stuff, which is a big deal and connected to the mob and organized crime and all that kind of stuff. So to start off with that is actually, I think, a really good background to come, you know, as you said, to come in and talk about this stuff here in the United States, where you know, we seem to just really like corrupt, awful politicians. It's just they don't exist in the UK, because they do, but some of the stuff that's gone on the Hill. We'll talk a little bit about the formation of the committee. I want this to be like a kind of an overview for people that might not have been paying close attention to it, because as I recall, there was a push, as you said, to make this really be a true bipartisan thing. And it kind of got flummoxed, and Kevin McCarthy overplayed his hand, and it wound up where, am I right, where Pelosi just like, okay, we're going to have Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and the rest of you can fuck off. Is that how it happened, or what was the genesis of it? Refresh our memories.
Well, a lot of this started immediately after the Capitol attack happened. You know, it was Pelosi who was standing, you know, among these kind of shards of glass, broken glass in the Capitol. And she turned to her leadership colleagues and said, you know, we need to do an impeachment process again to hold Trump accountable. And she said, the second thing we need to do is investigate what happened today. And this was January 6th, obviously. And she, I think, announced pretty shortly after that she intended to have some sort of fact-finding mission. And eventually this idea of a commission kind of took shape. She had a couple of other side projects, like she had General Honoré do a security assessment of the weak points at the Capitol. And this culminated in a security supplemental bill around May, June, that the House passed, and then the Senate passed a separate version. And so when Republicans say, you know, why aren't Democrats focused on securing the Capitol? Well, I think they are. And in fact, they already have. And the only thing that's remaining really now is to investigate the Capitol attack. So I think around in the spring, I think Pelosi tried to reach an accommodation with McCarthy and McConnell to have some sort of a 9/11 style nonpartisan commission where Congress wasn't going to get involved. They wanted a commission that had no congressional constraints to do its job. And then obviously what happened was Democrats can pass this in the House without Republican votes, but McCarthy went and made a desperate plea to McConnell to stop this from happening, because he was worried that whatever the commission found, there could be blowback onto members of the House Freedom Caucus's Republican conference in general. And McConnell agreed that at the time, this would be very, very damaging, both to the GOP and to Trump at large, and the Trump movement and the Republican movement at large. And so it was filibustered in the Senate, and this whole thing died. And a couple of weeks later, Pelosi had another leadership conference call. These things typically happen on a Monday around, I think it was like 3:30, 5:30. And leadership huddle and they figured out what do they want to do. And they went through a whole different number of steps, right? They thought, well, we could either do a select committee, which is comprised of, you know, Republicans and Democrats, but Pelosi in the organizing resolution would get a lot of a say and leeway over how it was created. They could have the House Homeland Security Committee, which was chaired by Benny Thompson, to just go ahead and do its own probe. You could have the House Homeland Security Committee subsume other probes because the House Oversight Committee was doing its own thing. The House Judiciary Committee was looking into something. So you could have the House Homeland Security Committee lead all the investigations, or you could just have no probe at all, right? Because we'd had the Senate Judiciary Report coming at the time. And so, and I think Jeffrey suggested, you know, passing some sort of resolution that would get the Justice Department to appoint a special counsel. Ultimately, they agreed on a House Select Committee. This was Pelosi's preferred option, and this was Hoyer's preferred option. I think Jeffries got overruled with the special counsel proposal, and they decided to make Benny Thompson the chairman because he and John Katko, who is the number one Republican on the House Homeland Security Committee, with whom Thompson originally negotiated the framework for this commission that never happened, they thought he would be the best placed person to lead it. And so we have this current composition. And there was a lot of back and forth right at the time about how many Democrats would be as opposed to Republicans, and was it equal, would they have equal subpoena power? And actually, if you look back at those negotiations, Republicans would have had a pretty strong hand. They would have had equal number of Democrats and Republicans on the panel, equal subpoena power. The only catch was, of course, that Pelosi would get to decide which Republicans served on the committee, right? Because if she was right that if McCarthy decided to put someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene on the committee, it would be a complete disaster. And so this was the catch, and McCarthy said, no way. And I think Trump's allies and Trump himself are actually now retrospectively pretty upset with McCarthy, because the end result is you have a Pelosi-appointed committee, no Republican allies of Trump at all on the committee. They, as you said, you know, McCarthy overplayed his hand a little bit, and you basically have the most unified committee, I think, in congressional history, leading an investigation into one of the most consequential moments.
Which is good news for people in the United States who are not Trump or his accomplices and partners in crime. I mean, that's one of the weird things about this. When this happened, we're all, you know, kind of watching it on TV and following it along on Twitter and whatever else. And by this, I mean actually the insurrection, the besieging of the Capitol a year ago. And we all kind of knew in the moment, like, well, you know, Trump is obviously in on this. I mean, so really the question is, was he involved in the planning? And the answer seems to be yes. And now it's just a matter of, are we going to find this out? Are we not going to find this out? Are there going to be smoking guns, or they're not going to be smoking guns? It seems like in the last couple of weeks, certainly from your reporting, it's going more in that direction. What do you think is going to happen there? You know, do you think we're going to get some kind of smoking gun, or do you think we're not?
Well, I think we have a lot of smoke. I don't know if we have the actual gun yet. You know, it's tricky, these investigations, and it's tricky because the committee doesn't, I don't think, has a complete picture of what happened yet. We don't have a complete picture of what the committee knows yet. So it's difficult to say. I think they did get a lot of material from Meadows. They did get a lot of material from other witnesses who have been cooperating. And this has played a huge factor. And, you know, these congressional investigations really need momentum. And once they get going, they really can get going. And they can, and I think there's a lot of momentum on their side now. There's the Supreme Court case that is likely to be resolved, you know, in a couple of months. And it could see the committee really getting their hands on the most sensitive documents that Trump wanted to shield from the committee. And, you know, that really would be game over for Trump, right? Once he loses at the Supreme Court, it's done. It's the end of the road. And it also sets a precedent for all of the other documents that he might want to shield in subsequent document requests. So with that and Meadows' text messages and communications, only a sliver of which, by the way, has been released to the public, and only some of the damning ones were read out at Meadows' contempt vote, I think they may have enough material ultimately to make some sort of criminal referral, which is the hot topic on the moment, at least for the political operatives and very possibly for Trump.
And I think it's important for them to do the criminal referral, because there's a lot of people talking on Twitter, oh, if the if the Republicans win the House, they can tear this commission down. They could do this and this. But once something is referred to the DOJ and a case is open, there's nothing that they can do about it at all. It's just, that's it. The DOJ might not do anything with it, but it exists and it will keep, you know, continue going. I want to talk a little bit about the players involved here. You mentioned some of it because I think, you know, it's sort of fascinating from a bystander's point of view to put together all the stuff that probably happened and to try to, you know, make sense of it all. So I'm going to throw names at you, if you don't mind. And just to, you know, tell the listeners really how they might be involved with not the insurrection itself, but the story around the insurrection. Because some of these people, you know, they gave speeches on January 5th. They were staying at the Willard Hotel, that kind of thing. So let's start with the three, like, in my mind, the three principal bad guys, which are Stone and Flynn and Bannon. How do you see them relating to all of this?
Yeah, it's interesting you start with these guys because I think the first thing to remember and the one thing that everyone forgets is that Bannon hates Roger Stone and Roger Stone hates Steve Bannon. And these guys will never work together. And it all goes back to a thing a couple of years ago when Bannon said something bad about Trump and Roger Stone erupted and said, oh, you know, he's not a real Trump-loving guy. And there's been no love lost between them. And so when people think about, you know, and you're basically referring to the Willard Hotel, right? And then this kind of war room / command center. So when people think about this, I think it's very important to remember that these were separate groups. The thing about Trump and the Trump White House is that there's a lot of factionalism and there were different groups with their own identities and their own agendas. And Stone and Flynn, they were one kind of group. Bannon, Giuliani, Eastman were kind of a different group. And I said this in a tweet quite recently that, you know, they were in separate war rooms at the Willard.
Right.
And it's possible that these two interacted, and it's also possible that these two never interacted. It's also possible that Flynn ended up as a go-between between these two groups because Stone and Bannon hate each other so much. They hate each other so much that Stone said in his Telegram channel recently, oh, you know, maybe it was Bannon who gave the order to attack the Capitol and effectively try to throw him under the bus. And then now you have Peter Navarro come out and say, oh, you know, we didn't need to attack the Capitol because we had all these Republican congressmen on our side. So it's a real mess. But what's clear is that Bannon played a very large role in January 6th. Both on the political element and quite possibly on the violent side for several reasons. On the political element, he was in touch with Trump and had a lot of influence with Trump, much more than I think people realize. You know, people think Trump kicked him out of the White House in 2017 over the Charlottesville stuff, and he was in like a limbo zone. And he was for a bit. But if you think about why Bannon was kicked out of the White House, it was because Trump didn't like the idea of people portraying Bannon as the kind of puppet master behind the scenes, and Trump was just regurgitating what Bannon said. It wasn't that he just thought Bannon was a bad strategist. In fact, I think he still thought Bannon was a very good strategist and was quite willing to listen to his advice. And, you know, tellingly, you know, on the night of January 5, when we reported, he picked up the phone from the White House and caught up the Willard. He made at least two separate calls. He caught up these lawyers at the Willard, like Eastman and Giuliani, on a kind of privilege call and told them to find ways to stop the certification from taking place at all. But then he also called Bannon, and he called Bannon individually and he called Bannon separately. And he conveyed to Bannon that, you know, Pence didn't seem to be playing ball. And I think that's really significant, and it shows the amount of influence that Bannon had even at that late stage. And it's interesting that he called Bannon personally as opposed to someone like Flynn, right? In the weeks before January 6th, around, you know, late December, Trump was prepared to host people like Sidney Powell and Mike Flynn in the Oval Office to just listen to any ideas they had because they were throwing out any old ideas and he was desperate to, you know, see what options were left. By the time they got to January 5, it's clear that Trump knew that Flynn and Sidney Powell and all the Kraken stuff was absolute bullshit. And he knew the only way back for him to survive another day was to go by the word and to go by Bannon. And that's why I think Bannon played such a large role, and probably in ways that we don't know yet, and probably we may never know because he's not going to cooperate with the committee. But he definitely played a role in terms of organizing the political elements. You know, he reached out to members of Congress, it sounds like now. He certainly orchestrated this idea of having Pence throw the election to the House where there was a majority GOP delegation. Bannon is quite savvy, I think, in that he's one of these guys that wants to do everything by the book so that anyone that comes back to him later, he can say, you know, we're above reproach because we, the method we wanted to use, the scheme we had to return Trump to office is not illegal. It wasn't unlawful. We were just going to use House rules and have a contingent election. All we needed was Pence to throw it to the House and we would have won. And so, that was kind of Bannon's idea. And then separate to that, you had kind of Stone and Flynn who were throwing out all these really kooky stuff about declaring a national security emergency, and Bannon wanted nothing to do with this. So when you think about the world, I always think it's important to remember that these are two separate groups. You have Bannon on the one side and Flynn and Stone on the other.
Okay. No, that's an important point. And the Bannon stuff seems to be corroborated by the Navarro stuff that's in the memoir, that Green Bay sweep kind of thing and the football metaphors and this and that. I was interested to see whether Bannon was going to talk to the committee because he likes to talk because he's done it before. I think now he just feels like it's going to be some political thing where he can go to prison and be a martyr and whatever he wants to do. But I thought that it was at least a 50-50 shot that he'd just show up and talk and just, you know, say whatever, lie, not lie. You never know with him what's going to come out of his mouth. But I'm glad you made that point about everybody having their own agendas, because I think that's when people are, you know, people trying to do conspiracy theory kind of things, the way those things are wrong 9 times out of 10 is that people assume that everybody has the same motive, when in fact, any group of individuals has, if it's 12 individuals, they have 12 different motives for doing whatever it is that they're doing. And to suggest that any of the 12 are the same is, you know, 6 people won't agree on where to go to dinner. Yeah, to overthrow the government, you're going to have disagreements and stuff like that. So I think it's a really important point.
Yeah. And I think the thing with that, like the one thing that unites them all is they all want to please Trump, but again, for different reasons, right? Stone just likes being a dirty political operative. That's just his thing. He likes to cause chaos. So long as it benefits him and it benefits his candidate of choice, which in this instance was Trump. Bannon, I think, it appears to me that he's thinking more long-term, right? They all think that Trump is going to run in 2024. They think he runs and he wins. And when he wins, I feel like Bannon is trying to set himself up to become chief of staff. That's the kind of sense I get. And so everything he was doing is to kind of try and get a pat on the back from Trump. So when he told the committee, I'm not going to cooperate at all, again, you know, as we have seen through the 4 years of the Trump administration, this was to an audience of one. And this was so that he could show to Trump, look, I'm the most loyal out of all of these guys. And so, you know, when you're looking for a chief of staff and you want someone really loyal to you personally, you want to look at someone like me because, hey, guess what? I'm prepared to face criminal contempt. I'm prepared to face jail time, and I'm still going to do your bidding. And I think that's really important. Like, these guys are playing a really long game. And I've always thought the only instance in which Bannon even considers cooperating is if there's jail time or significant jail time on the table and he strikes some sort of plea deal. If it's just fines, Bannon is not going to care. He spent millions and he raised millions during the Mueller and the Russia inquiry to pay for his legal defense. I mean, he hired William Burke at Quinn Emanuel. He's the top kind of constitutional and election and, you know, defense lawyer there is in Washington. This guy was on retainer. He had like 3 lawyers on retainer, and William Burke is probably the most expensive. And so if it's just a fine, he will easily raise that in donations via the War Room or Save America PAC or whichever he decides, and it will be a bit of a cakewalk for him. And I think this is why he's been treating it as a joke. The one thing I will say, though, is he was always prepared to testify to the committee if it was public. And it was because he wanted to be on TV and he wanted to make all the election conspiracies come to life. Because if Bannon was testifying at an open hearing on Capitol Hill, everyone would have streamed it, right? All the networks would be there. You know, this is don't invoke Giuliani and his all the networks, but they would have all broadcast it live, and he wanted to air all the nonsense he had.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because that's what I meant by I was sort of surprised that he didn't testify, just because he likes to talk and he's often a source for things. I think that at least one of the first Bob Woodward book, Bannon clearly was the main source for that. I mean, he's, you know, the guy can't keep his mouth shut. It's kind of crazy, but that's really good analysis. I think you're right about him, you know, trying to position himself that way. And God, Chief of Staff Bannon is to President Trump redo is a bad, 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 bad thing.
Well, better maybe than Stephen Miller, but yeah. I mean, choose your character, right? I mean, the thing I always thought about Bannon is, and then this goes back to the origins of the Trump movement. All the rest of the guys, like Stone, they're kind of hangers-on. The one thing that Bannon has going for him is that he is the father of the Trump MAGA movement. It was all his pet project, right? He was at Breitbart. He liked this populist idea. This was, you know, the entire Trump project was Bannon's thing. And so he knows the base better than anyone else. And I think Trump realizes this. And Trump doesn't always get the pulse of the base quite accurately in the way that Bannon does. And I think this was why he was so reliant on Bannon in the first years of the administration. You know, when he's talking about vaccines now, he's getting booed at his own events. Mm-hmm. You know, that didn't happen when Bannon was in the shadows.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. No, Bannon definitely has the finger on the pulse. And I think Bannon is a really smart guy. And, you know, a lot of these people on my list that I'm looking at who are involved in this thing are not really smart guys. I think, you know, that's another thing that unites some of these people is that they're not the brightest bulbs on the tree, you know. So let's, speaking of not bright bulbs on the tree and speaking of chiefs of staff. Okay. So Mark Meadows, talk a little bit about who he is and how his, because I think whatever decision he was going to make about what he was going to share and what he was going to do, he has bungled it very badly in that now he's going to both reveal things he didn't want to reveal and probably, you know, maybe get in trouble in a criminal sense by doing that. So it's like, it's a lose-lose for him. Am I reading that right? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Mark Meadows this was interesting. I think there's a bit of backstory with Meadows, right? When he was still in the House, before he became chief of staff, this is a bit of an anecdote. I mean, I don't know how true this is, but it kind of fits and it gives you a kind of a sense of the kind of guy he is. He used to walk into the House press gallery, the daily press gallery, where I normally work most days. And he was talking to these reporters and floating the idea that he was in contention for chief of staff. And this wasn't exactly true. He was basically trying to find a job in the private sector when he left Congress. And he knew that if he was a potential White House chief of staff, the salary expectations would be higher. And so I think he was trying to plant these stories. At some point, he planted the stories a little bit too well. Trump caught wind of the fact that Meadows could be a good chief of staff and then actually just asked if he would be chief of staff. And then Meadows found himself in a very difficult position at a very difficult time when Mick Mulvaney was persona non grata after the first impeachment. And so he kind of had to accept. And so I always thought maybe Mark Meadows became White House chief of staff by accident and not by his own choosing. Against that backdrop, you know, he... And I think this is evident, right? In all the big Trump moments, Mark Meadows appears a little bit confused at times. Like when Trump got COVID, you know, Meadows was doing off-camera briefings, well, except the audio and the mics were live, off-the-record briefings to reporters, telling them that Trump's oxygen levels were extremely low, right? And then same with the January 6th stuff. He was receiving PowerPoints and that recommended Trump to declare national security emergencies, and he was meeting with the authors of the PowerPoint in the freaking White House. He was the White House chief of staff. So Meadows always appears in really bizarre places at bizarre moments in kind of the final year of the Trump presidency. But yes, to answer your question, I think he has made a bit of a miscalculation. He was in fact the very first subpoena that the committee issued. I know this because I broke the news. They were considering like three to five subpoenas, but the top of the list was Meadows. They really wanted his communications. he started engaging with the committee fairly shortly after the subpoenas got issued. And I say engaging and kind of quote marks, right? Because there was a lot of discussion with his lawyer, George Terwilliger, who's the ex-Bush DOJ guy who was involved in kind of, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, a whole bunch of kind of potential wiretaps on people and all sorts of unsavory things. But he was engaging with the committee. And then when Bannon got held in criminal contempt, I think Terwilliger and Meadows kind of sat up and thought, we don't want to be in that same position. And so they reached this accommodation cooperation deal, except the cooperation deal was a little bit tangled. The committee thought they were getting, and they announced that they were getting a full cooperation deal with Meadows. This was their understanding of the discussion, that no topics were off the table. He would come in for a regular deposition. He would produce documents that were not privileged, and it would be pursuant to a subpoena. Now, if you went and asked Terwilliger about his impression of that deal, it's very, very different. He thought there were topics off the table. They weren't cooperating pursuant to a subpoena. He could withhold documents on a privilege log. I mean, it was just completely different. And I think all of the reporters who cover this beat day in, day out saw this was going to be a bit of a car crash at the end of the road, because you had two sides expecting two completely different things. And I think this is classic Mark Meadows. So he produced all these documents because he didn't want to be held in contempt. I think it's important to note, though, he also produced the documents, right, that he wanted to produce.
Yes.
You know, he went through his own records and thought, do I want to give this up? Yes. No. So, you know, and then this was the kind of decision making that went in. The problem with these cooperation deals is you have no idea if he's withheld stuff that is really damning, that is not covered by executive privilege, because you don't have a search warrant to go search his personal files, right? This is not a law enforcement investigation. This is a congressional investigation. And they don't have the power to be, you know, ordering FISA wiretaps and getting subpoenas for personal records. So, you know, they were operating on a kind of a good faith basis. And I think Meadows probably, well, it sounds like, operated on a pretty good basis. He turned over 6,000 documents to the committee, including this coup PowerPoint that I reported on, which was just totally crazy and kooky. And initially, I didn't even want to run the story because I thought it was so ridiculous. And my editor said, no, we have to do this story because this just encapsulates the final dips of the Trump administration. And so
it really is. I mean, the theater of the absurd. I mean, it gets more and more absurd.
Right.
The visual of Meadows in the tent that day with Junior, I mean, has any human ever looked more uncomfortable and pretending to be happy in a place than Mark Meadows? I don't know. It's really sad. But yeah, it's absurd.
Well, this is the thing with Mark Meadows. I think he was uncomfortable all the way through. And I wonder if was because he got the chief of staff job by accident. Really,
that's a great story.
I don't know how much of it's true. It's kind of anecdote and kind of jokes that we pass around in the gallery when they've got late night votes. But it obviously came from somewhere. So I'm prepared to ascribe it a certain degree of credibility, especially because the person who was talking about it is a very credible guy. But
Trump does that. Trump does that. He does. I mean, he hired Bill Barr because Bill Barr sent him a thing. He basically lobbied for the job. It caught the attention. I mean, I don't think, especially that late in the game, there were not a lot of people that were willing to take that job. I mean, I think the list of people that would have taken the job, knowing that, my God, I'm going to have to be hiring defense attorneys for the rest of my life, you know, who's going to step into that? You got to get somebody that's not too bright. And hi, Mark Meadows. Yeah, I hope, you know, we'll see what job he gets when this is all over. I don't...
Well, he's at the CPI now. He's at the Conservative Partnership Institute, which has an office just north of the Library of Congress building. I actually saw him the other day. He was not game for an interview, but he did take my cards. I wonder if he called me back. He changed his cell phone post January 6th, so it's difficult to get a hold of him sometimes. But the problem of his cooperation was he gave all these documents to the committee, and in doing so, incriminated a whole bunch of Fox News hosts, Don Jr., members of Congress. And it all came out, and you know, we did some reporting recently that when Trump saw these texts being read out on TV, he literally just turned to someone and just said, "What the fuck is going on?" Because he was so shocked and so disturbed by what he was watching on TV. And he did this without any discernible gain. I mean, he was still held in contempt because he then refused to appear for a deposition on materials that he had already produced, and in doing so, tacitly acknowledged that they were not covered by executive privilege. You can't go into a deposition for non-privileged materials that you voluntarily gave to the committee and say, oh, I can't talk about these because they're covered by executive privilege, after you've already turned them over. And so I think he found himself in a very difficult position, and it came because it culminated with the release of his book, lots of unflattering details about Trump's COVID incident, and Trump really railed against him. In fact, I heard that Trump was really furious with Meadows over the book, and was even more furious after he learned that he had cooperated, and then effectively stepped in and said, you know, Mark, you're not going to go for this deposition. And I think Meadows caved, and that's at least what the committee believes as well. And so he's now found himself in criminal contempt, and let's see if he gets indicted.
He's made the committee mad and Trump mad. So he's nowhere.
He's made everyone hates him. Democrats hate him. Republicans hate him because he's been thrown under the bus. Fox News hates him. Literally everyone hates him. And so I think he's in this very difficult position. His book sales are tanking a little bit, from what I heard, because he doesn't mention anything about Jan 6 in it. And that's all people want to read about. I think he devotes like 2 pages to it. But, you know, he is one of these guys that really was involved, because he acted as the White House liaison between Trump, members of Congress, and the kooky people that Flynn interacted with. I mean, the coup PowerPoint, as I call it now, ended up in his inbox. And then, as we said, he went and met with the author at the White House, and he was involved in setting up briefings with members of Congress. He was involved in discussions with Pence's team. So he really was at the nexus of all of it. And if there's one guy that knows anything or everything, it is likely to be him. So I don't know how the committee will get more information out of Meadows. They may not. Again, it may be an instance where they get, you know, he and Bannon get jail time and they work out some sort of plea deal to testify. But Meadows is in a very, very dark place.
Everybody hates him. He and Ted Cruz should form a support group. I think it would be good. We have to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with Hugo Lowell. When I found out that BetterHelp was going to be a sponsor of the Prevail podcast, I was thrilled, because, you know, this is such a great service, and it's something I think people really need. I think it really fills a void. I mean, there's major mental health problems going on in the country right now because of quarantine issues and pandemic issues. And if you listen to my podcast, you know, we're all under, you know, we've been traumatized by this Trump guy, right? So along comes BetterHelp. They assess your needs, match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You connect in a safe and private online environment, so it's super convenient. And you can start in under 48 hours, which is great, because you don't want to go, you know, try to find a therapist, and then you get, I have an appointment in 6 months or whatever. It's just, you know, 2 days, there you are. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if you need to. And they're available for clients worldwide. I know we have people listening that aren't just in the United States. BetterHelp, worldwide. They offer a broad range of expertise, which may not be locally available in many areas. Because sometimes, you know, local therapist, you live in a small town, maybe it's somebody you know, it's awkward. This is a wonderful way around that problem. They have licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleep problems, trauma, anger, grief, self-esteem, sexual and gender identity, you name it, they've got it. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they're actually recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. Start living a happier life today. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Greg. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greg, G-R-E-G, for 10% off your first month. Thanks, BetterHelp. We're back with Hugo Lowell. You talked before about, you know, the story you wrote inside the Willard. Important point that there's two different, basically, command centers. One is the sort of Mike Flynn, Stone, wackadoodle people. And then there's the lawyers. And the lawyers are basically, you've got Giuliani, you've got John Eastman, who was, I think, originally this was his brainchild, this kind of let's do this thing. Eastman is also the guy, by the way, who wrote the piece in Newsweek about how Kamala Harris wasn't born in the United States. Yeah, that's who he is, you know. Then you've got Boris Epstein there, that was an interesting name. He came into the mix, by the way, because he went to Georgetown the same year as Eric Trump, and they knew each other from there. That's how he, I think, met the Trumps and got involved with that. And am I forgetting anybody? Those are the main lawyers.
And Bannon. Bannon was not the lawyer, but was in the right.
Yeah. So what do you think their role is? Do you think that it is a sense of they're just trying to do it by the book so that when and pull back from the violent aspect of things? So to give Trump almost like an escape route, I guess, where he can say, well, me and my lawyers were saying, we're just trying to do this. It's in the founding documents. I didn't want any violence and that kind of thing. Is that, do you think, why they kept it separate, or what's your sense?
Well, I think the two war rooms are separate just because Bannon and Stern didn't like each other.
Okay.
Obviously, Giuliani and Flynn shared, you know, witnesses, right? Phil Waldron, the guy who authored the PowerPoint, was a election fraud witness for Giuliani, but he was also making the PowerPoint at the direction of Mike Flynn, at least according to our reporting. So, you know, you have people who are go-betweens between the two war rooms. I think Bannon has always considered himself more of an intellectual, and he didn't want to get bogged down in Flynn's really kooky conspiratorial stuff. So I think that's where he naturally aligned with the lawyers. I don't want to say that the Bannon war room at the Willard was just involved on the legal stuff and the above board stuff, because I don't know, right? It's certainly possible that he was also involved somehow in the violence aspect of it, and then the kind of physically storming the Capitol. I just don't know. You know, the phone call that I reported on that Trump made from the White House to the Willard, that was only one call. You know, I know that Trump made several calls to the Willard that night. Mm-hmm. And at some point there were calls which didn't involve Bannon, such as with the lawyers, because Giuliani was a stickler for attorney-client privilege, and he thought having non-lawyers on the call, quite rightly, would jeopardize that attorney-client privilege protection. And this was what they were relying on to keep their conversation secret should this all come out later. There were also conversations unrelated to the fact that Bannon wasn't a lawyer, because Bannon went for dinner at some point in the evening of January, late night on January 5. I'm not sure if he left the hotel or if he went to dinner in the hotel, but there was several windows when Bannon just wasn't around. And so it's quite possible that Trump had additional calls with his lawyers. In fact, I think it's very probable. We just don't know the content of those calls. So it's quite possible that the lawyers were also connected to, you know, for instance, the Oath Keepers. I don't want to say no, because I don't have the reporting to say that didn't happen. But certainly what we do have reporting on, they were all focused on how could Trump survive to fight another day, right? This was the entire thing. Regardless of the violence or no violence, what Trump wanted was for Biden not to be certified on January 6th. As long as January 7th rolled around and there was still no president certified, this would be a win in Trump's book. And, you know, we kind of saw this after the Capitol attack ended and the rioters were flushed out of the Capitol. Giuliani was still calling up Republican senators saying, you know, just object to all the states, because Giuliani knew that each objection yielded a narrow debate, and if you did all the remaining, it would basically kick it into January 7. And then we're in a legal and statutory gray zone. You know, you're supposed to have a president certified by January 6. What the hell happens if you have no president certified on January 6? And you're in January 7, January 8. And we said in the story that it all came as part of wider discussions that Trump and his team wanted to delay the certification so there was more time for state legislatures to send Trump slates of electors to Congress, which in itself is all nonsense anyway, because I think there's a provision in the Constitution that says all the states have to be sent at the same time. You can't have individual states recalling slates and sending it's not like trading cards. So I don't know how strong the legal plan was anyway, despite there having, you know, three lawyers. Like Boris Epstein is also a lawyer. Yes. So he would have been on the calls. So it's a very interesting dynamic. I think there's obviously more to it there. Giuliani's gone AWOL, and I think it may all come out when Giuliani gets subpoenaed. I understand that there's a subpoena for Giuliani in the offing.
That'll be interesting. Giuliani, who said on January 5th, demanded the trial by combat, right? Isn't that what he said? So to your point about the nonviolence, trial by combat, that seems to be violent to me. Giuliani has always sort of espoused these violent sort of things. And it'll be interesting to see what happens if and when they talk. Rudy is another one who loves to talk. So I can't imagine him staying silent. I know what I wanted to, like, Roger Stone met with the committee, I guess, right behind closed doors, and then said after, I just took the fifth every time. But like, can you imagine, like, that Roger Stone just likes to talk so much that the temptation to answer the questions would be so great. I just wonder if he really did, or if he just couldn't help himself and just blabbed. I don't know.
It's a good question. I asked the committee this afterwards, and a pretty senior committee aide said, he was under the impression that he didn't answer the questions, but he wasn't there a very long time, and it's possible that the committee had, committee did have a lot of questions for him, so it might have just taken time to work through. My guess is that he didn't answer the Fifth Amendment to everything, because that's not how the Fifth Amendment works, right? Like, if you're asked your name, you can't invoke the Fifth Amendment privilege to not tell them your name. So he obviously had to answer some questions, and I wonder if And actually, judging by the Telegram channel message afterwards, I wonder if he just told the committee, oh, I think Bannon, ordered the attack on the Capitol, just to throw Bannon under the bus. I've always thought if any of these guys testified and they were all trying to score points for themselves, this is exactly what they would do, because, it's perfectly reasonable for a witness to generally opine about what they thought happened and, draw dots under the guise of trying to help the committee. When they know it's, or even if they know it's all nonsense, because you're going to say Stone was lying. I mean, you'd never be able to prove this. It'd be a perjury case in this instance would be unsustainable. So I always thought this would be a tactic that someone like Stone would use.
Stone would use any tactic that he possibly could to skirt the truth and anything else. What's up with this Scott Perry guy? Because I've been paying pretty careful attention to this, and until I heard his name being, I guess he wasn't subpoenaed, he was just asked to cooperate and stuff like that, I'd never heard of him. I thought Scott Perry was either the guy from Journey or the guy from Aerosmith, or the two of them combined together. I had no idea there was a congressman named that. Why do you think they started with him? What would, there's other people that whose names you heard who were more Gosar and Biggs and these guys that were affiliated with Ali Alexander. Why do you think they started with him?
I have no idea. I'll just be straight up. I have absolutely no idea. Look, I think the important thing to remember at this stage with them asking members of Congress to cooperate is they are trying to plot a more conciliatory approach than they did with the early subpoenas, right? The problem that the committee ran into and what they realized is you can't be really aggressive and just subpoena people. But if they decide not to cooperate, you have to now refer them for criminal contempt, because this is the precedent you've set, right? You can't now stop referring people for criminal contempt. You've already done it with Bannon and Meadows. You now have to do it for everyone who resists the subpoena. And this is a problem, because the criminal contempt procedure is a punitive measure. It's not a coercive measure, right? At the end of the day, you don't get you're not guaranteed to get the testimony. There's no court order that says, okay, you've been indicted, now you have to testify to the committee. It's just, you're going to go to jail, pay a fine. And these guys know this. And if it's just a fine, they'd much rather take the fine and not have to testify. And this is a problem for the committee, because, ultimately the committee doesn't really care if Bannon goes to jail or not. They just want to know what happened, right? So they can do their report. Like, Bannon actually being in jail doesn't really help them. In fact, it probably hinders them. And the only benefit they get is maybe other witnesses say, oh, okay, maybe we should cooperate so we don't want to end up like Bannon. But if you have real diehards, they're not going to cooperate. And then you've just closed off an avenue for potential information. So the committee realized I think, a little bit late that this was not the route they wanted to go. And this is why with Jeffrey Clark, they made every accommodation for him. You know, when he said he was ill and couldn't appear at the second scheduled position, they were very, very accommodating, because they really didn't want to go down, and they don't want to go down this criminal contempt route if they can avoid it. And I think this is reflected now in the request for information from their fellow lawmakers. There's also this element that they're not sure yet what the eventuality will be if they subpoena members of Congress, right? Because it's completely unprecedented to have a congressional investigation that subpoenas members of Congress. We've never had that before, because in every instance previous to this committee, members of Congress have just volunteered to cooperate or agreed to cooperate. And so we've never been in a position where you've had recalcitrant witnesses who are members of Congress. And I think they're very cognizant of that. And they know they have to tread very carefully, because the moment they start subpoenaing Republican members of Congress, it will be war. And McCarthy will explode. The House Freedom Caucus will explode. It will just be the 117th Congress would effectively cease to function. Republicans would do everything they can to just stop everything. So they need to be very careful how they do this. It may be that they need to subpoena them ultimately, because people like Scott Perry are not going to cooperate. Jim Jordan may, who knows? But at the end of the day, if they have to refer members of Congress to Justice Department for prosecution, it's going to not only be difficult getting information from them, but it's not even clear you can secure a conviction. So this is going to be a real test for the committee, and I think they're still trying to grapple about how to do it.
I think this is an interesting point, because those, you know, people like me on Twitter, we just want these guys in jail. You know, that's what we want. We know they did bad things. We want them away from this, and we get very impatient. So I think it's an important view to there's a strategy involved here, right? Where the strategy is, how can we get the testimony that we want from these people without pissing them off so badly that we get nothing, and turning it into this, you know, this war zone, which, by the way, if the Republicans take the House back, they're then going to turn around and do the same thing to the Democrats about some dumb bullshit, because that's, you know, that's what they do. But the other thing that's important, I think, is the optics. Right. The whole, I have always wanted there to be a commission like this, because I want the story out there. I want people talking about it. I want it on TV. Just like, you know, when you were saying, oh, we want 24 hours of televised things that people will stream. I want that too. I want these people to be in front of Congress answering questions. And I want even Fox News to have to report on it. Even if the committee, I mean, it's as you say, it's a congressional committee. It's not, they can't do anything to the people, other than refer them to the DOJ. They don't have that power, but they can put pressure by showing what's happening. They can create pressure on both the DOJ and the American public to pressure people to do kind of the right thing. And I feel like with the subpoenas, if people do start going to jail, Bannon is one thing. He's a, you know, almost his own individual unique thing. He's like the Demigorgon or something. But some of these members of Congress, like if all of a sudden five members of Congress wind up defying subpoenas and are and wind up, you know, in jail, people have to ask, why would you do that? I mean, why would you go to jail rather than just tell everybody what happened? We saw what happened. You know, the Senate was besieged and you were there because we saw pictures of it and you look scared. So why can't you come talk about it? I think the optics for these people would be terrible if that happened, which is just, you know, something else to consider.
I mean, at some point I start to think these guys don't care about the optics. The only thing they care about is if they're reelected. I mean, this is the problem, right? If you, for instance, if you subpoena Marjorie Taylor Greene and she refuses and you hold her in contempt and she gets referred to the Justice Department, she will have the biggest fundraising quarter that she's ever had.
Yes, sure.
And she will play it off, and she will only gain strength within the House Freedom Caucus and her base and the Trump base. And I think you have to think about, like, do you really want this, right? The one thing that Democrats learned from kicking members off committees, whether it's Marjorie Taylor Greene or whoever else, I'm trying to remember who they were thinking of kicking off
I can't remember. Yeah,
I should know. But the lesson they learned was, if you kick them off their committees, they have a lot of idle time and they're frustrated because they can't get the donations and the political advertising and then the political contributions rather from, you know, the companies that have a vested interest in these committees. And you get people like Marjorie Taylor Greene who spend all day pulling antics like motions to adjourn in the House. And, you know, this is one of the minority tools in the House of Representatives. And it backlogs legislation because, you know, she pulls a motion to adjourn at 12 p.m. or, you know, during morning hour in the House and no one is around to object to it. And, you know, it passes and the entire day is adjourned. And then you have this backlog of, you know, 50 suspension bills that need to be passed. You know, some of these are must-pass bills, and you can't pass them because Marjorie Taylor Greene's busy, you know, screwing up Congress because she's got nothing else to do all day. I mean, do you really want these guys to grow in power because you're holding them in contempt of Congress? I think Democrats are starting to think that maybe this is not what they want. And I think this is why there was such a lukewarm reception from Pelosi and House Democratic leadership to pull more members off the committees. And I think this is also reflected in how the committee is progressing, because what they don't want to do is to embolden people who might have been connected to the insurrection.
Interesting. Yeah. No, interesting points. Interesting points. Okay, we're winding down. So I've got one more question for you, but it's a doozy. So you had this great story you alluded to earlier that Trump was agitated. What the agitated was the word you used. By the select committee, his tweets are getting, they're not tweets really. I think he just writes it on a cocktail napkin and hands it to somebody who takes a picture of it and then puts it on Twitter. It's effectively that. They're getting more and more kind of crazy, but also targeted. When Trump gets mad, the language that he uses in these tweets, it's sort of pretty easy to see who he's mad at. So my question though is about the whole thing, okay? He knows, I think, deep down that he lost. Why did he want to stay there so badly? Like, what it was it just about? I have my theory here, but is it just about power? Is it because he had things going on that he didn't want anybody to know about? My theory, I'll tell you mine, and then you can tell me yours. I don't think he was trying to, at least on the insurrection day, I think it wasn't his own election that he was after or attempt to hold power. I think he wanted Pence gone and Pelosi gone so that someone else in the line of succession could be made president if he resigned, that would give him a pardon. Because I think he's a crook, and that what he needs and what no one else can give him is a pardon. I don't think he can do it himself. I think he probably thought about it. Maybe for all we know, he tried. That's what I think. I may be wrong, but what do you think it is? What's the big deal? Just go away, you know, take your money, go to Mar-a-Lago, be with Melania. You guys are in love, you know?
that was a sharp comment at the end. I don't know if that was, that was a little bit below the belt. I mean, I will just say though, you know, it's quite possible that he did sign a subpoena for himself in secret and just didn't tell anyone about it. Because you can do that, right? You don't have to make the
Pocket pardon.
Subpoena? Yep. Pardon. I mean, maybe he subpoenaed himself, who knows? But maybe he signed a pardon for himself. You never know. But I think that is an interesting theory. I've not heard that before. So that's interesting thought. I actually have come to the point where I now think he self-deluded himself so much that I think he actually believes he won the election. And there's no way he could have lost to a guy like Joe Biden. Not Joe Biden, who lost, you know, the caucuses and was behind all the way through until the very, very end, you know, Sleepy Joe. And I think it rankles him that, you know, everyone says that he lost. And I think as someone who is an optics guy more than anything else, he hates the optics of losing to an old man. And this eats him up like nothing else. And I don't know that he does, you know, I think he can't bring himself to believe that he lost. And so surrounds himself in these conspiracy theories and self-deludes himself into thinking, actually, the only way this happened was that it was stolen from me. And I think actually he may truly believe that it was stolen from him. I mean, I don't know why he would want to stay in power. He never liked the nuts and bolts of governing, but he did like the trappings of it, right? He did like living in the White House. and he did like the idea of signing executive orders. And he has always been a power guy, and he's always been a guy that has wanted people to take him seriously. And I think back to 2016, 2017, and there was a good story once that a friend told me about how, you know, when he was in New York and he was a real estate developer, no one took him seriously. And then he came to Manhattan and he built Trump Tower and he was, you know, he made it to the board of Rebney, the real estate board, and still no one took him seriously. And then he got himself into the White House and still no one took him seriously. And I think this really, really eats him up. So he's always been hungry for power, and, you know, all power corrupts, right? And corrupts absolutely. And I wonder if 4 years in the White House has corrupted him to an extent where all he wants now is more power. I wouldn't put it past him.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's an interesting point. Hugo, this has been fantastic. You're on Twitter at Hugo Lowell, right? There's not anything extra. It's just your name. Okay, so on Twitter at Hugo Lowell, that's HUGOLOWELL. You're at The Guardian. You're doing terrific work, and I encourage everybody to follow you on Twitter and to read your excellent reporting. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing. Keep up the good work. And I was going to say Happy New Year, but everybody listening to this, it's already January 6th. So happy anniversary of the insurrection. Insurrection Day.
Yeah. I honestly don't know how to feel about that. When I saw him announce that he was going to have a press conference on January 6th, that was exactly my reaction. And I caught up by it, and I was like, I don't care what we're doing on January 6th, what the anniversary coverage, but I'm not going tomorrow on January 6th.
I think that's wise. I think maybe you know, come on, Tish James, let's get him. You know, that's a good day to. Remember David Corn used to tweet out, today would be a great day for Donald Trump to release his taxes. January 6th would be a great day for him to be indicted by the state of New York, I have to say. That would be a great way to spend the anniversary. So, Hugo, thanks again for joining me. This was really fantastic. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely. No, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you for having me on. This was a good fun, and we should do it again sometime.
Yeah, please.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.